All right. Ready,
Okay.
sir?
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to call the September 25th regular meeting of MetroCard to order. Matt, would you just call the roll for us?
I sure can. Mayor Hoidick,
Yeah.
Town of Stratford, thank you. First Selectman Rooney, Town of Monroe.
Here.
Christine Brown, proxy, First Selectman Vitale, Town of Fairfield.
Here.
First Selectman Bindleglass, Town of Easton.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave. Ken Flato, proxy Mayor Ganem, City of Bridgeport.
Yeah.
And First Selectman Tesoro, Town of Trumbull.
All right, I'm here.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
Let's stand for pledge.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So we have a full house here this morning with a great sound. I have some guests. So before I start anything else, I'd like to introduce Sean Scanlon, our controller.
Yeah.
Welcome. And how would you introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. Anthony Naples, Director of Policy at the Comptroller's Office.
Great. Thank you.
Frank
Oh,
Batiste
sorry.
is our new Director of Public Works in Fairfield. Frank comes to us from Stanford and is really familiar with the folks in Westpac, and I thought this would be a great opportunity for him to meet the MetroCon.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh,
Great. Nate, Assistant to the Comptroller.
nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Okay, so I'll return to the agenda and ask if there's any public participation.
We do have one, Ellen Graham from Pool and Bob office.
Great. So, Ellen, did you say? I'm sorry.
Oh, yes,
I
Ellen
can't
Graham
see the
from
screen all the way back.
Right.
Okay, so Ellen,
Hi,
welcome.
everyone. Good morning. I just have a really fast update. Again, Ellen Graham, Senator Blumenthal's office. We are uncertain about a government shutdown. It's looking more and more likely, but we will keep everyone updated as soon as we know anything. The NDAA is moving along through the Senate, already passed the House, so we're keeping a close eye on that, making sure Connecticut is well represented there. That's really it. If anyone has any issues or problems, please feel free to reach out. I will include my email and phone number in the chat.
Thank you very much. Anyone else for public participation this morning? One more time. Anyone else for public participation? Okay, hearing none, we will move on to our approval of the meeting minutes. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes from June 26, 2025? Do you want to do both at the same time? And August 13, 2025.
I moved.
Thanks, Laura. Any second, please? Don't be afraid.
Where's David? David usually does the second.
We need a second. Anybody willing to give us a second?
Dave.
He does.
Dave.
Okay. Any discussion about both sets of minutes? First, June 26th. Hearing none, how about to August 13th? Okay, so hearing none, and no further discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone against? Okay, passes. Okay, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Sure. Yeah. The next item on the agenda, item four, is presentations. First, we have Comptroller Scanlon. Well, thank you for coming down and look forward to your presentation.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, I don't want to disappoint you. I don't actually have a presentation. It's more
Well,
of just
discussion.
a conversation. So I know, I think many of you in different capacities and served with some of you in the legislature, but I've been the comptroller for about 2.5 years, going on 3 years. And I am a sucker for trying to solve what are seen as sort of intractable problems. And Laura knows this. I've been successful in reforming the MERS system during my time as the comptroller and passed the first two big reforms to that program in about 50 years and saved the taxpayers of a lot of our towns a lot of money. And we just instituted a new tier of that, which will help future towns hopefully save money that join. including the city of Bridgeport here. But I'm really, really interested in looking at the property tax issue. And it's something I hear about every single day. People are very frustrated by both in municipal government and just regular citizens. And I think what I'm trying to do here is just have a series of meetings with all the different cogs around the state to get some feedback from them about what ideas they might have. And I know that every 5 or 10 years, somebody comes along and says, hey, let's try to solve the property tax issue. And then a report comes out. That report collects dust because the issues that are within that or the recommendations are that are within it are usually unpopular or third rail-y or all of the above. But I'm interested in trying to do something a little bit different here, which is to say, I think there's been some really previously identified big public solutions to try to address the issue. And when I talk about the issue, I think I'm really talking about three things. The first is just municipal finance, how municipalities raise revenue and the problems inherent with that system. The second one is about state aid, right? The future of that, how that works. And the third, of course, is regionalization and sharing services. And that's the three things that have mostly come up as part of these conversations and the three things that always come up as part of this, because those are the three inherently, in my mind, most important structural challenges that are, in my mind, holding the state of Connecticut back if we don't address them in some version. And so rather than just kind of put out a report without any feedback from people, I'm going to every one of the cogs and sitting down with folks and having conversations and trying to get ideas from people about what they would like to see done at the state level to potentially make the system better or more sustainable. I love these meetings because in every meeting, somebody says one idea and then somebody else says, that's a terrible idea. We shouldn't do that. And it underscores how challenging this is. But we have gotten a lot of really good ideas at these meetings so far. And in my one-on-one meetings with different mayors and first selectmen across the state. And my goal here is to maybe come up with a consensus of some ideas that maybe are not the home run solution to these problems, because those are very hard politically to do, both at the local and the statewide level. But I also think we can start hitting some singles and get some consensus around some singles that show people that it is possible to make progress on this. And I think if we can get some consensus around that, I think it's a good start to what has been a big, big problem in our state for a very long time. And I'm willing to kind of put my political capital on the line to work on this, because I think it's, if you look at all these different problems that people talk about with our state, I think a lot of them can be traced back to the property tax system and the unsustainability of it. So that's why I'm here. I'll stop there and just really just open it up to anybody for their ideas, their questions, their thoughts, their concerns, whatever you want to talk about.
Anybody want to start?
I mean, I am happy to, but if you guys want to go first, that's fine, because I talked to Sean off.
No, well, you know, we could talk about this probably all day long, you know, and, you know, the issue with Connecticut with 169 different communities, different sizes, different forms of government, it's not an all fits one size conversation.
Yes.
You know, I could speak about my town and the problems we have with, you know, almost over 95% of our taxes come from, our revenue comes from our residents and our businesses, and very little from federal government, very little from the state. And, you know, over the last few years, our state aid is actually, I don't want to say it's decreased markedly, but it has decreased. It has not increased. So we never know where that number is going to come out. And when you're trying to do your budget and that number fluctuates, it makes it very difficult. As far as regionalization is concerned, it's a great concept, but how do you do it? You know, there's a lot of...
That's what I'm counting on you to have the answer for.
Yeah, I wish I did. I believe there should be regionalization. I think, you know, having, again, 169 communities, and we don't have 169 school systems, but we got a lot. So we've got, you know, many superintendents, and there's many places in this country where, you know, you've got hundreds of thousands of students and you may have one superintendent. You know, we have 7,000 students in Trumbull, but we have one superintendent. I'm not taking anything away from what anyone does, so for sure. We have a great school system in Trumbull. But nonetheless, how do you do that? We have these these words that we talk about, but how do you make them work? So that's just, I'll just stop there and I'll chime in as we continue to talk.
Do you want to continue on the education? Because you didn't mention education as one of the main issues. And it, I really think it is. I think she should have one more. I think there should be four.
Yeah.
And the governor focused on that a little bit, and the General Assembly focused on it a lot, especially around special ed. And some of the things collaboratively that we came up with was a regional approach for special ed services that all of us could participate in, which is a good thing. And they had some funding available set aside for that. The General Assembly did pay excess cost last year. They gave us a bump in excess cost, which was helpful. And in this year's budget, which is also helpful, it's the State Department really needs to focus on their vendor costs and those that they're allowing to work in the state that we have to subscribe to, and those costs that are pushed another mandate, Sean. It's just like another one more thing that we have to pay for. But I think that's probably a big part of all of our budgets that we could get around and support. So that's one. And number two, which is not such a big deal, but it is to a lot of people, or is energy. I read something that somebody said we have to deal, the systems benefit charge has to go away. Well, unfortunately, the systems benefit charge makes up all of the energy savings, the energy efficiencies, the sustainable green programs that the state of Connecticut is invested in, and maybe it hasn't worked so well, but we're paying that freight too. So I don't think we could throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think it has to be moderate. I mean, that's where you put your reasonable approach to saying we have to work with the utility companies.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. But those are two big parts of the municipal budget that affect property taxes.
Yeah, I mean, for us and probably most communities, education takes up about 70% of our tax dollars.
So that
is, you know, we can't talk about that enough. We had a $1 million over budget in outplacement tuition.
And that's the part, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's the dialogue that we've had at CCM all around with the governor. And the governor was really good about listening to us with this. It's getting the State Department to actually move.
Yeah. I have a lot of questions that I can ask you, but I wanted to think for anybody else that hasn't said anything, I'll just chime in.
I'll just chime in one more time about our, because I like to do this because I've probably known around the state for doing this, but the ECS formula. I fight this every single year because I've yet to really find anyone who can really explain how that formula works. And we were one of the towns that were put
it
on.
It works
that.
How they want it to work.
Right. Yeah. And that's not a good answer because we were put on that list of the accelerated decrease in our ECS contributions. So, and that, you know, started when I first got elected in 2017. And I'm worried that it's going to start up again this year. So I just don't know. I think we're okay for this coming year, basically getting what we got last year, but that still isn't enough for Trump. I'll stop there.
And Ken Flato had his hand up. Go ahead, Ken.
Sorry, I was trying to get this mute thing. No, just briefly, I think the other big concern that there's a lot of confusion about is on the car tax issue, because obviously we all love the legislator and legislators trying to reduce car tax burden. But some of the proposals, I don't quite understand if they reduce but don't reimburse the cities or towns, then how does that help the property tax burden? I mean, you know, car tax is over 10% of our grand list. And we obviously, you know, rely on that money as much as it's hard for people to pay it. So I don't understand the methodologies they're trying to propose that might diminish but not reimburse at the rate that they promised that they would reimburse. And I don't know if you've been involved in those discussions or not at all, but just thought I'd throw that at the table.
I'm not involved in it, but it's a common story, right? And as a recovering legislator, I can talk about this, right? Is the idea of my friend Ryan Fazio, who's running for governor, right? He's proposing a property tax cap. I'm all for a property tax cap. I think it's a good idea, but it can't happen if it's just happening in a vacuum where you're then tying the hands of the municipalities. It's got to be coinciding with other reform. The car tax is the same way. You can't just get rid of the car tax and put on your flyer, "I got rid of the car tax," when you're just shifting the cost to your local mayor, first selectman, town council, or whatever. And so I think why I'm trying to do this is to see if you can do it like holistically, where what's a package of things that could be put together that it's not yin and yang, right? Where we're one side and then leaving the other side open. That's something that I don't think is really happening right now, especially in Hartford. Not criticizing them, but it's easy for them to, with good intentions, try to solve problems without sort of figuring out how the back end is going to work.
Hence the housing bill.
Not talking about the housing bill or the monopole today, but
Yeah,
that's I'm just kidding.
that's the
We
example.
could talk about whatever you guys want to talk about.
Thank you.
So I have questions, but I want to give anybody else who hasn't said anything a chance to weigh in if they want to.
Dave has Dave in the back.
Okay. Dave, go
Yes.
ahead.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for
Hey,
coming.
Dave.
So two things just to kind of echo two of the things that were mentioned. In terms of the car tax, we've had this huge post-COVID influx, like most of the towns, and the car tax is just such a foreign creature
Yeah.
to anybody who comes to this state from anywhere else, and it's a huge source of confusion. I would almost tell you, put it dollar for dollar in the income tax and get rid of it, and return it to the people. So it's a net zero, but it just messes with people. It's just a, why are we doing that? It just doesn't make sense. And Ken's right. I mean, we can't give away the revenue. That's crazy. But it's just hard to explain, and it just makes people crazy. And I think if it went away somehow, that would be a huge plus. The second point I would make that kind of combines regionalization and education, and Laura was going there, is that special education is a huge issue, obviously, and we all know that. But if you had to pick out one piece of it that really kills the towns, it's outplacements. So, particularly in a little town like Easton, in January, a family moves to town and you have one kid, God bless him, who becomes a $250,000 outplacement. And your education budget is destroyed. And so, if we were to find ways in the state to provide that more efficiently, and that probably means pooling, not just the state, but pooling resources of districts, so that those costs could be controlled.
Yeah, that is an issue I'd say that comes up almost every time we do this because it's such an issue where obviously every town wants to do the right thing, but they have to do the right thing. But that right thing can be very, very costly, obviously, to them. So
And I mean,
we
we're
have
not
that.
going to fix all of special education realistically either. It's a huge drain on all of our budgets, but if you're looking to hit singles,
Yeah.
that might be at least somewhat lower hanging fruit.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the ideas that's been floated to me that I've sort of thought about a little bit is after a certain threshold of the cost of the outplacement, could the state kick in? So, that way towns know there's going to be a baseline to what this cost is going to be, and they could budget it if they knew that, but then the rest of that cost would be covered by some other entity, whether it's the pool thing you're talking about or just the state picking up the cost.
That's excess cost, theoretically.
I know, but I'm saying if
Yeah.
you did it specifically for the
Oh,
outplacement.
okay.
I was actually almost going towards, can we provide the services that are generally taken up by outplacements in a more effective way by doing it? It's almost worth it for the state to set up, or regionally for us to set up
Got it.
institutions that are actually capable of handling what we now outplace.
Yeah.
Cooperative boards of education, the, you know, those kinds of things, make them better.
Okay.
I agree with what Dave is saying, what Laura is saying, because, you know what, you know, it's great to say the state will pick up the expense, but there's no guarantees of that.
Yeah.
And when you're budgeting and you don't have a guarantee, and then it doesn't happen,
yeah.
then it falls back on the residential taxpayers again.
Yeah. Well, if I can, that's a great segue to sort of one of the major questions I'm trying to answer through this process, which is, I hear what you're saying that you feel like the state aid has gone down. If the governor was here, he would tell you he vehemently disagrees with that.
But I'm not going to say it hasn't gone down drastically, but it certainly has not increased.
Well, I think the problem is that we just did this report last month that showed that while it's true that he has added more money, it hasn't kept up with the rate of inflation. And so that's why a lot of towns are now seeing less money than they were, because even if the budget has added more money for your towns, you're not getting as
much. I'll just give one example.
Yeah.
Is the sales tax revenue that disappeared in the middle of the budget season last year with really no explanation other than the letter that came out. Sorry, we don't have enough money to pay it. And we had already budgeted for it for 2 years.
And you had those letters coming from OPM.
Yes, I just love
it. So speaking of that, I think that the two most common things that we've talked about through this process are two ideas to let municipalities kind of control their own destiny when it comes to having more revenue. One option would be to give towns the ability to raise other revenue by creating local taxes if they want to. The state not telling them what to do, but the town, let's say you live on a beach town, and in the summertime you have, and this is a real world example that has come to me from an elected official, we have dozens of people that rent their houses on Airbnb. And why can't we do an Airbnb tax if we want to? Those people crowd our roads, they call 911, they do all these things, right? So giving towns the ability to raise other revenue that they don't have right now, it can be your own restaurant tax, you can do your own income tax. I'm not saying they're all good ideas, but it just gives you the freedom to do your own thing. The con of that is if Bridgeport has a 1% restaurant tax, does somebody say, I'm not going out to dinner with my wife in Bridgeport, I'm going to go to Stratford, or I'm going to go to Fairfield, right? Because I don't want to do that.
Here comes trouble.
Or go to trouble. So then the other idea would be to set up a uniform tax across the state and then have that money not go back to Hartford, but to go to the COGS and get redistributed. So there's, let's say, call it 1% more added to the sales tax. But instead of you getting the 1% you get now and then getting the letter you're talking about from OPM, that guaranteed 1% or whatever you generate in your town. So whatever Monroe generates in sales tax, it goes to the COG and then it comes back to them. It's not through the state at all. I'd like to hear some thoughts about those two ideas.
I hate raising taxes.
But the option, if you wanted to, if your community wanted to, do you prefer that as an option, or do you prefer a more uniform thing across the state so that the towns were not necessarily competing with one another? I'll give you another option on the first one. I was in a rural town in Eastern Connecticut recently that has a very big fair. I'm not going to say which town it was. And I met with their board of selectmen, and they said, look, we're all huge fiscal conservatives. We hate taxes, but we don't get a dollar from the biggest thing that happens in our town every single year. We should be able to tax the fair. And I was like shocked that they said that. And they said, look, I know I'm a fiscal conservative. I don't want to tax anybody, but this is the biggest thing that happens in our town. Our town loves it, but it's also a big inconvenience for us. And it's a huge missed opportunity for us. So that's another example where maybe you don't like taxes, that's fine, but there's an opportunity for you to raise revenue that then would decrease the pressure that you have right now on your property tax base. Just an option.
So as a shoreline town, and someone who doesn't like to raise taxes, but as a shoreline town, I agree with whoever told you that the Airbnbs are creating havoc.
Yeah.
Okay. So I concur. And just so long as if the state decides to allow this, they don't decide to allow everybody and their brother to come to our beaches without any kind of check and balance system, because, you know, our friend
yeah.
proposes that bill every single year.
Yeah.
I think that's a reasonable way of doing things. But I do like the COG approach because then it's not Bridgeport, Trumbull, Monroe, Fairfield, Stratford against Easton against each other
Yes.
as far as like a restaurant tax. You'd have to bulk up for collecting it and doing everything that you would have to do as a COG executive director. But I mean, at least we could spread it through the region. So I think that makes sense.
It's not like we're so geographically dispersed that we can afford to compete with each other because it's too easy to travel from one municipality to another because we're smack up again. You don't even know when you're crossing the town line. So anything that introduces competition, I think, between municipalities would not be a good thing.
Okay.
I would offer also that in Fairfield, one of the biggest issues we have, which is I think a little different from the other communities around us, is the presence of two large universities who pay no tax.
Okay, that's my next point.
Yeah.
Next question.
So they're a tremendous drain on town services. And if but if that land were commercial or residential, it would the amount of money we would collect in taxes would far surpass what we're getting back in pilot or any other funding mechanisms that we receive through them. So that's a big problem for
To
them.
that point, unless anybody wants to go back to that other equation, a question about pilot would be, and again, we're talking about things in unicorn fairyland right now that are
Right.
just theoretical, not politically possible. But thoughts on changing the pilot system and potentially studying whether things should be taxable at the local level and removing some of the exemptions on local taxation around pilot.
So I feel really guilty saying this before because Ken is not
I was
here
gonna, I
to defend
wanted to.
himself. But the airport is in Stratford. We get no taxes, but Bridgeport gets the pilot.
I know.
I know you don't. I'm just gonna get the soapbox
Yeah.
again. So I get it. And I'm having conversations with a local large university who wants to come to Stratford and I'm or a hospital that wants to
Wants to
have
expand.
branches, doctor's office in Stratford, or nonprofits that want to come to Stratford. Yeah, we want them because we're all a great big community, but then trying to balance with the lo loss of property tax revenue is hard.
Well, I would add just not it's not specifically on the pilot piece, but for especially the urban cores of the state, the inability to assess properties that are purposely underutilized and underdeveloped, and they'll just be held for decades without developing and not being able to recoup what the highest and best use assessment would be on that property is, I mean, the city of Bridgeport has 55 or so percent untaxable land. And a lot of the taxable land is underutilized, contaminated, undeveloped. So they're unable to kind of push the property owners to develop because it's they're paying
No incentive.
no, yeah, there's no incentive to move that development forward. And that's a huge strain on the city of Bridgeport specifically. I know everyone in this in at this table has some properties that would fall into that category. But I think it's more prevalent in the urban centers that you have these undeveloped lands that are just held by certain people for years and years and years and years. There's no incentive to develop it. They're only being assessed a very small amount on it because there's no real property to assess on it. It's an abandoned property, completely underutilized. So there's a fiscal strain on that there's no real way around unless there's a reform to the assessment capabilities that municipalities have on those types of properties.
There's also an argument to make that while this would be very, very politically difficult to do, the nonprofits, for example, are always coming to Hartford saying they need more funding. And if we were to end the pilot payment, that doesn't help them at all. It doesn't help, they don't pay taxes, but it doesn't help them do what they do. And you tax them, and then we took the pilot money and invested more in the nonprofits. It could be a way to do this as a win-win for everybody. Because it's basically shifting the money, but it's shifting it in a way that benefits all the people involved. The town is not being screwed because they're able to get the same money that they were getting, frankly, more money because they could tax it at the rate that they wanted to, and they wouldn't have to worry about the state messing up the pilot formula. And the nonprofits could get more in terms of the funding that they're looking for because the state would have more money that they're not sending to you for pilot.
I don't know how Justin Ellicker would say say what he would say to you about that.
He would say 70% of my city is not taxable. And this massive institution that is a part of my city and is not moving anywhere is going to pay taxes, as opposed to having to negotiate every 10 years some sort of voluntary payment system. That is a really, really difficult thing. And you could have some sort of tiered approach for different kinds of people that are tax exempt right now, where large profitable hospitals and universities with billion-dollar endowments would be taxed differently than a homeless nonprofit, right? But again, these are just conversations.
Are there any examples of other states that have a taxable nonprofit system?
Yeah. And I think it goes without saying in this conversation that almost every other state, blue and red, has a very different system than Connecticut has, right? Kick me out when you've got to
go on. No, I was just not about you at all.
Another question on the financing. We were in a meeting yesterday, and we were talking about sort of maybe the regressive nature of the property tax in the sense that it's a tax on unrealized gains, right? So my neighbor and I literally live next to each other. Our houses are the same size. I have two kids in school and a young family, and they're in their 80s. We pay the same amount of property tax, right? We use different services and we have vastly different incomes. Exploring a system in which the property tax you pay is based on the income you make versus just the value of your home or your property. Thoughts about that?
That would take a further understanding of what the difference would be. And, you know, again, the loss, is there a possible loss of revenue to the municipalities by doing that? Who makes up that difference again? So,
it wouldn't be a loss if you figure out a way to do it in which the town stays whole, but the tax burden is redistributed based on your ability to pay it. Don't shoot the messenger here. I'm just telling you the idea.
But the devil's in the details. So I don't know what that means. But, you know, if your young family then gets hit with this huge increase in tax based on the fact that they are earning more money, they may have a different opinion whether they can afford that than we do. You know, so I don't know. I'm just throwing things out there.
And they definitely would have a different
opinion. Yeah, they definitely would have a different opinion.
It's just a question of
and I'll be in Florida.
If we were doing this over again, right? If we were starting from scratch, would you design the system the way it is right now? Probably not.
Well, just following what Laura said, do we look at other, you know, if there's a different way to do this, I don't know, it's better, whatever, just different, and some other states than what we do. Do we really delve into deep looking at different ways to handle this than what Connecticut does?
The most common way that states would do it, again, red and blue, is a county government that levies county taxes, yes, and those taxes then get redistributed for sheriff's departments, for fire departments, for schools, for garbage collection, and that sort of redistribution happens naturally at the county level, not at the local level.
Trying to switch to the cog
right
region.
Right. So, I know we've talked, there's been discussions about that. So so let me tell this, excuse me one second. Anne-Marie, I see your hand up. So sorry, would you like to
All the answers in Seymour, I know it. Let's hear it.
That's right, from Salem. So actually, it's funny that you're talking about property taxes because, as you know, Seymour just went through a rebal, and our young at heart residents are in an uprage because, you know, they're on fixed incomes. So I've been meeting with them and speaking to them, and they feel that, you know, we don't have kids in school, so why should I be paying for these kids that are in school, even though taxes did pay for those kids in school? And I sat there and I said, well, my kid was in private school for 16 years. I said, so I paid that plus that. But we sort of come up with an idea, and we're looking at it from a legal end of it, is that if you're over the age of 65 and you've lived in town for 20 or 25 years, that you get 10% off your taxes. And then the following year, you get another 10%. And the following year, you get another 10%. And then it's only up to like a percentage. But should you leave your home, or should your home go into an estate, like say you left it in an estate for your son, you have lifetime use, then you're not paying the taxes on it and it goes into somebody else's name, then that reverts back. I understand what you're saying, as you know, is maybe what you said, Sean, about, well, you know, the young at heart really can't afford what we as younger people may be able to do because, you know, we're not in that retirement age. But that's almost like as I said, a social injustice, because a single mom can't afford an additional while paying for her kids, especially in today's economy, or two people who are just making it to keep a roof over their heads and put the food on the table with everything. So I don't think that's the way to go, but maybe a percentage off their taxes and look at it that way. And I know we had that circuit breaker program that was funded way back when that is no longer funded. Maybe we can look at things going that way.
The flip side of that single mom analogy, which I totally hear, is that right now, let's say that single mom inherits her parents' house, the parents move to Florida, her tax rate that she's paying for the property tax takes into consideration not at all that she is a single mom. She might be living in a 4,200 square foot house, but her income is not what you may think would sustain that kind of lifestyle. And right now, that isn't taken into consideration at all. So she gets hurt sort of either way. In Guilford, where I live, we still do the referendum. I'm sure a lot of towns do that. And we've historically had big problems always passing a referendum because the seniors, no matter what political party they were in, would come out and vote no on every referendum because they didn't want their taxes to go up. We passed a program called the Senior Tax Freeze that if you hit a certain level of age, your taxes get frozen where they were. We don't have problems passing a referendum anymore because people get the senior tax freeze. And so I think your idea of, you know, the 10% at a certain point, age, and if you live there a certain is sort of going in that same direction.
I think so. I know we're trying. We have, as you know, we have a referendum coming up to build a new school, and it's the battle has begun. It's okay for the school to be 7 years old. The kids don't need air conditioning. We survived, so why can't they? That was last night's battle. But then you were speaking about taxable on a local level. You know, we are not on a waterfront, and I believe that competition's a good thing in some things, but if we're competing to get people to go to our restaurants or Ansonia's restaurants or Derby's restaurants, and I won't say the other S word, then it's kind of tough to keep businesses in because they're always looking for the other who has the best mill rate to go into for your businesses. And really the young at heart really can't afford, as we hear, any more taxes, and it's becoming where even people my age can't afford any additional taxes. So if we can look at a different way of maybe not calling it a tax or maybe calling it a fee or something, then that might work. And then just going back, because my hand was raised before, when we're looking for the special ed, the special needs, could the money follow the student? So say a family, special needs, they wanted to come from Bridgeport to Seymour. Could that money follow the child from Bridgeport into Seymour?
Meaning if they move there?
Yeah. I know it would really mess up the town's budgets. I know, because we have people moving out of Seymour and going to different towns, and we still, you know, or coming in actually, and we didn't plan on that for our budget for the special needs. So we have that. But I know that the Valley mayors and superintendents were speaking about doing a regionalization, maybe at St. Mary's School in Huntington, or St. Lawrence in Huntington.
I'll make a note. I don't.
Well, you're making a note. Burden approved too, as a note.
Okay. On the education, and again, please kick me out when you've had enough of this and you're going to move on. The biggest cost, you guys have talked about it, is education administration and the schools in general. I know that regionalization is a third rail and people don't love the idea of regional school districts, but what about regional administration? So there would be one superintendent for a series of schools. You wouldn't be in a regional school district. Nobody's kids would get bussed from one town to the other, but instead of having seven superintendents, there's one superintendent over all of that regional school district. So that person, the principals report to the regional superintendent, but there's still local control. Thoughts about that?
So I think I'm the only one who lives in this world at the moment. You know, we have a regional high school and we have one superintendent who oversees two towns and a regional high school. It is extraordinarily difficult to keep someone in that role because he's doing three budgets and meeting with three boards of education. And, you know, maybe there's a better way to do that. But we blow through superintendents like nobody's business because we just burn them out. You know, they're at meetings four nights a week, certainly from January to May. It's just very difficult. That's just my two cents on that.
I think it also has to deal with the service delivery. We are used to receiving a certain customer service. I happen to like it. We are not part of the regional dispatch system because of the customer service, and we have it built in. It's more expensive for us, I get it. So, but we made that choice. And I think with the superintendents, especially after COVID, to be honest with you, I think we are just getting our feet underneath us, and test scores are starting to go up, and staff and families and kids and superintendents, administrators are really feeling stronger together. I think that's one of the areas that COVID was a benefit, because we saw what we could lose and if we went remote and not touchable and not as close. So that is not, I'm not crazy about that idea. And just like David said, there's a reason why these superintendent salaries are so high. It's because they do a lot. They're also, you know, they're in high demand. So, you know, it's kind of okay. Feed the demand. We expect a lot. We expect a lot in Connecticut. And I think that's a standard. I don't know if we want to lower.
You know, for our town, the school system is our magnet. It's really what attracts people to Trumbull, besides our parks and all of the other, you know, pools and all that stuff as well. We don't have a train. We don't have a beach. We have our schools. Mm-hmm. And most people that move into Trumbull move because of the schools. So I'm not saying that there isn't a way to work this differently, maybe mm-hmm. under the county umbrella system again, you know, because we know that other states do, you know, have much larger school systems with much fewer administrators at the top. They do, and they work. I can't speak for myself because I don't know how they work and how well that the school systems do. We know Connecticut has overall, if you look at it, has, you know, a great, just a great state for education. In most places, not all. So I know there's all great ideas to talk about, certainly, I think, about ways to, because we have to do something, obviously, because the property tax system is failing. So
it's paralyzing us.
Yeah.
I think that generally that concept forms.
You want to go ahead? Go to that.
That's all right. Keep going.
I say that concept, I think, of merging tends to work when there's underutilization. But certainly in Fairfield, everyone who works in the school system is maxed out. So they don't have capacity to share with other districts. And I'm only speaking for Fairfield, but I would imagine it's the same for most of these school systems. So in a place where the school systems are very small, towns are small, spread apart, that might be a great idea because maybe they're underutilized, they have excess capacity, but I don't know if this geographic area meets that need, has that need.
I'm just hearing, you know, $100,000 solutions for multi-million dollar problems. You know, to take a superintendent or we regionalize it, I mean, how much does that save your community? $100,000, $150,000, even if it saves $200,000. If it saved me $200,000, that was eaten up by a reading program that was a non-paid for mandate by our state legislature. So I think if you want to look at reform to help our property taxes, I think, you know, obviously special ed needs to be reformed. We have to look at the outside vendors for sure. They give a price tag and we have to pay it. And that has to be looked at. because I don't think any vendor that's in the spirit of helping children in need should be using that as a greedy grab. Okay. And we see that. We see that in every single municipality, right? I think that's something. The unfunded mandates absolutely have to be corrected, whether it's in law enforcement, whether it's education. Every year, there seems to be something that comes out that the state does not fund. Now, I'm not here to have a battle with the state. I understand legislature has their reasons to do things. I get that. But that's the burden on these towns, and that's the burden on every single leader in this room. When you put together these budgets and your citizens yell at you and say, my taxes went up, a lot of the reason why the taxes come up has nothing to do with the town leaders. We are reactive to state legislation. So if you want to fix the local property tax problem, you need to fix the state legislature and make them understand how their ideas and concepts are impacting towns. The cities seem to have very large pockets. They seem to get three new schools. Bridgeport alone got three new high schools. I need a high school. I need a new school. Know how hard that's going to be. And every single citizen in my town pays state income tax and a lot of it. Okay. So if you want to fix this problem, that's how you do it. You look at special ed, make sure that is reformed to the point where it works well. We're not here to say we don't want to help our kids. We absolutely want to help kids. We're in full
Sure.
support, but that doesn't mean that it should be taken advantage of and used to line the pockets of people that do that type of work. So that's my
I appreciate
advice.
that. One of the things that's on our list is an unfunded mandate review done by our office and OPM to do a comprehensive look at all of the state mandates that are currently on the books right now, and then determine which of them are funded and which of them are unfunded, because nobody's done that in a very long time where there's been.
Go to the ACIR report. We have to do that report every year. Excuse me. That's a good starting point anyway.
You just raised the point. Do you like what Benny Glass was talking about maybe pooling it with other towns? Is that something you think that would work for Monroe if you were to pool it with other similar towns?
I don't think there's a large enough savings to really save us on the tax, the property tax.
You're saying just the cost of the actual
Yeah, I
outlays
mean,
then?
you take a couple hundred, even if it's $1 million change, what is it dispersed amongst? You know, I think special education is a big pressure. You know, I think a lot of the state mandates are a big pressure. And if that's what you're going to look at, I commend that because I think that's where you need to look. You know, and that's where people complain. Well, you know, every time I get an education budget, do we want to take care of our kids? Of course, we want to take care of our kids. We want to make sure the money's getting to the kids. Okay. Administration in education is extreme. And in Monroe, it's very top heavy. Now, I'm not saying they don't do a great job, and I'm not saying they're not good folks and they don't have good intentions, but that burden goes on to our seniors, onto our taxpayers, even our young families. And like Vicky, our draw is definitely our schools, right? Our schools are a big draw. The parks, the safety, there's more to it. Nice, clean, run towns, right? But it's a lot of pressure, and the seniors complain about it, and people complain about it every single budget season. And the reality is, it's relatively out of the CEO's hands. Right? We are subject to state mandates that we have to pay for. They have to be in there, or else we may lose funding. There's all kinds of things that could occur. And we want to do the right thing, but yeah, it's every year the education budgets are very extreme because of the unfunded mandates. And I think if you start looking there, I think that'll help us out more than anything. Just do the right thing there. Get the state legislature to understand. You know, I think that's the biggest thing because they pass the laws and the governor can turn around and veto it. You know, and in the situation of the state legislature, even something like HB 5002, which Vicky and I and many of us were opposed to, that would bring a large amount of people into our school systems, which at the same time we want to educate people, but that would really hurt my town in particular because I have a lot of commercial properties that are undeveloped, you know. So the state legislature really has to understand, you know, what they're approving and how it trickles down to the communities and what those costs really are when you put together these budgets. And I think that would help.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just goes back to, again, I now see this in a different way, having been in the legislature and now in the different branch of government, right? Where they have good intentions a lot of the time, but they also are doing it because they want to pat themselves on the back to say, I solved a problem, but they're just kind of putting a problem on somebody
You know
else.
what they say, where good intentions get you someplace, right?
Yeah.
Well, a good example of that is the outcry last year with the change in the motor vehicle valuation. You know, the municipalities were like,
I get it.
you know, that
The veterans property tax. I get it. And yeah, all these things sound good. I understand. But
sure, throw one thing else out there. And if there's any possibility that there could be a review and how the revaluation system works.
okay. So, question about that. There have been some mayors and first electmen who have suggested that the state should pass a mandate that says the towns have to spread the reval out over a certain period of years. Do people like that, or do people feel like that ties their hands?
I'm not sure that's the only problem.
But you can do that anyway.
Right, you
We
can. That's right. You can
our
pass your own.
legislative body can phase it
Well, I
out.
guess he's making it so you have to do
Yeah,
it. You're right.
this particular person was saying, I have the option, but my community, some people in my community are saying, no, let's just get it done now. Some people want to do
Yeah,
it. But
that's a whole political
it's a
decision.
political decision, but I'm saying, I see what you're saying.
No, I think it's worth the conversation, obviously. I just, you know, towns that are lucky enough to have a mall in them, you know, the mall is the Trumbull Mall's our biggest taxpayer, but it's also been the biggest problem for us because we've lost millions of dollars of value in that mall over the last number
So
of
what are
years.
you saying is the biggest reval issue?
The fact that we have to, that you're forced to do it, like when we were forced to do it, and well, I delayed it in 2020 because I said no town should be doing a reval during COVID. And then we did it in 21, which was no better, right? So there should be some overreaching issues, exemptions, or whatever. But I just think having to do forced to do a reval in certain situations was can be deadly to your town. And talk about increasing taxes, that shift in that tax burden from the residential, the commercial to the residential was overwhelming for a lot of communities, not just Trumbull, but because we had that mall and still have, obviously, the mall still having problems there. You know, I delayed the reval again until next year because I want to give time for our commercial properties to recover a little bit more. But that's all politics again, but unfortunately. So I just think the whole system needs to be looked at as to, you know, do other, what are other states, again, what do other states do about revals? You know, in what's the cycle? We're on a 5-year cycle. Some are on a 10-year cycle. Some towns don't, and we'll go into that. Some towns don't do it at all. And what's the penalty for that when other towns are doing it? So I just think the whole system maybe should will be looked at.
Okay.
Sean, if I can interject. Thank you, Vicky, for bringing that up. What I understand with the reval is that back in the late 2000s, when property values plummeted in Connecticut, there was a decision by the state legislature to do a 5-year reval. Am I correct on that?
To switch to 5 years,
To
say.
switch to 5 years. Okay. So what we're dealing with after the COVID bubbles, we're dealing the reverse of that. We're dealing with a large
Inflated.
increase of property value. So our homeowners don't really get a break, right? So they got 5 years. They got a reval in our town, and I believe 2019, right? They saw a large increase in their property value, and then all of a sudden we get a 5-year reval, and there's taxes associated to that. You cannot lower the mill rate. Now, we lowered the mill rate 10 points, but you can't lower the mill rate low enough to stop the impact. I lowered the mill rate 10 points and gave $4 million in undesignated fund balance back to our people. And I got my mill rate down almost 10 points, and it still impacted the average family $1,200 to $2,000 a month. Okay. So the state put pressure, that reval put pressure on local leaders. Now, people like Vicky, who pushed it off to next year, and that's her decision. I didn't do it because I believed I was hired to lead the town. This is something that landed in my lap, and I'm going to manage it. And I'm not saying that
You don't
however
have a
people
law.
deal with it, however people deal with it,
That
they
makes
deal
more
with it.
sense
And
to
I
me.
don't disagree with what you did.
That's over
And we could
150
have,
million dollars of value. So.
yeah. And we could have also, waved it in. We could have just year after year, but I wanted to pull the Band-Aid off and get it done, give the undesignated fund balance back and try to offset it as much as we can. And that's what we did. But obviously, the 5-year reval was very damaging. And for years, I've owned property for a very long time, and every 10 years there was always a reval. This 5-year reval this time around was very tough.
So what if we
So
did what Vicky's talking about, where there could be an event that happens, whether it's the global collapse of the stock market like in 2009, or a pandemic, or some outside event that is a destabilizing force that could then.
I think that's how it should go. I think you should go back to the 10-year reval like it's always been. And if you have a situation that's impacting people drastically, then you could go to the legislature and say, listen, this is impacting our people. We can make a change. It's been done before. But to make it stick every 5 years, I think is extreme. Now, here's the other problem. My concern was if I didn't do the reval this year and interest rate drops, what happens? Now your homes go through the roof, and now your reval next year is at a higher cost of houses, and your tax impact to your people is even higher. But that's the risk we have to take.
Gamble.
It's a gamble. You're playing Russian roulette with people's money.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, but I treat this with a little bit of tough love because, you know, when I got elected, the biggest complaint was the values of our houses haven't increased in 20 years. So you can't have your cake and eat it too. You know, the good news is the biggest asset that you own just went up 30%, you know, and I'm sorry for that, sort of. But so, you know, yes, do we hate what happens to our taxes when the reval comes? Yes. Do we figure out ways? That's our job to lower budgets, to, you know, figure out ways to bring down the mill rate. But I struggle with changing that to some extent because you're penalized for this great leap in your personal wealth. It's a trade-off.
I think Anne-Marie has her hand up. I don't know.
Yeah.
I do. So the mill rate, right? Seymour, we had our mill rate in 2020 in the midst of COVID. Then we get hit with, oh, it's supposed to be every 5 years. We got hit with it in 4 years. If the state is saying it has to be every 5 years, then it should be every 5 years and not 4 years just to make sure we're going with the market. And the 10-year, right, they used to go every 10 years and they would come inside the house and look at it. And when I speak to my assessor, she's like, it's broken down 5 years. It's every 5 years. You get the outside of it. And then 5 years later, they come in and they do the inside of it. But when we have a mill, our assessment done in 2020, and then I have to hit them again in 2024 at the height of the market, it hurts everybody. If we're going to say we're doing it every 5 years, then we have to do what we say and say what we do. And I could have broke it up every 4 years and saying, okay, your taxes are going to go up a little bit, 25% this year, 25% the next year, 25. But then their taxes are continually going up and that's not being responsible. We could do, I just said, let's rip off the Band-Aid. But we had, my mill rate went from a 36 down to a 27. And it really should have been down to a 21, but because of the way we're now doing car taxes, we lost $1.3 million. And that's where I needed to be to get my down to my 21. So it was kind of, again, Sean, Seymour got hit. I'm not blaming you. I'm blaming Kurt Miller. So it's okay.
Okay. I won't tell if you said that.
He's not here right now, but it's, we have to look at way, we say we're doing it 5 years, then we're doing it 5 years. If we say we're doing it 10 years, we're doing it 10 years. There should be no changing. Only if there's a pandemic or only if a market crashes, that's when we should be changing it. Not because someone decides, oh yeah, let's hit it high now that the market is growing because all these New Yorkers are moving into the state of Connecticut.
But you know what I'm hearing though? It's moving the goalposts. Things are not stable for us. They're never stable. We can't count on anything, whether it's funding or mandates, and it's hard to manage when things are always moving.
Yeah,
that's a very valid point. Stability is very hard to find.
You never know what's going to happen anymore.
Well, that goes back to the, maybe this is a good way to wrap this up. That goes back to some of the biggest picture ideas that would essentially try to divorce municipal governance and municipal financing from relying on somebody else, in this case, the state, right? And if there was a way to do that, you know, that gets at that problem, right? But it creates other issues where you have to create new taxation, right, of people or new ways to tax them. And I know that that's not easy to do or find consensus on. So it's kind of like, how do you find that balance, you know?
Well, with the car taxes specifically, because everybody's talked about that. And do you remember why that car tax valuation changed? We were in the General Assembly when it changed. It was because the cities were getting whacked, remember, with the values and the insurance, and they couldn't make it work. So, David, though I don't love the idea of raising the sales tax or something, income tax, I think you said, if you could take the cars out of the equation, it's got to go someplace else, but maybe now we're only fighting one battle or focusing on one thing.
Well, there was a CCM proposal a couple of years ago that you raised the taxes on the 1% by 1%, and there was enough money there to then redistribute it, and you could eliminate the car tax. But again, you'd be counting on the fact that some governor and some legislature in the next crisis is not going to say, we can't afford to give you all that money because we got this. And then all of a sudden, that would only work unless somebody else was levying that, and that somebody else was going to guarantee to give you that money. And maybe that is the cop. But again, that means setting up a 1% income tax on people that live within your geographic area.
And how long will they live here if you raise the income tax? I mean,
Well, again,
I don't know.
that's a great counterpoint. But again, the difference there, though, is if every cog was doing it, you wouldn't have people saying, well, I can't possibly live in the Fairfield County cog. I got to go to Guilford, right? It would be a uniform thing across the board. But nobody wants to raise taxes. I understand that.
Well, it's shifting. It's not raising, it's
Risk.
shifting. Now I'm thinking like a
Well, no,
politician.
this would be raising taxes.
No, but
Because
you're
you're
seeing
eliminating the car tax because of
the
it.
Yeah. But the guy paying that tax
Is not the one.
is not the one necessarily benefiting from that. Because unless you are in that 1%, you are not paying that tax.
Right, but everybody's in the, so David's analogy is everyone's in the 1%. Everyone is.
If you did it with a
Is
sales tax,
if you did a
we did
sales
it.
tax,
but
Did
if
you get
you
sales or income tax, David? It's an income tax.
I
You
mean,
said income.
a car, I said income, but
Okay.
a car tax is essentially progressive anyway. I mean, look at what people drive. And, I hate to word things this way, but, rich people drive Mercedes that costs, that they pay $1,000 a year in taxes on, and other people drive whatever's that they pay 200. So you're kind of doing your 1% tax to some extent anyway. So, if you really look at it, you're not shifting income. You're not being as progressive by doing it differently than you are today. Does that make
Nate is
sense?
giving me the eye because I'm already
Yeah.
way past the time I was supposed to stay. And I know you guys have stuff to do. I appreciate everybody's candor on this, right? I mean, I'm just throwing out ideas that I've heard to get feedback on it, and I'm just trying to see if there's somewhere within here consensus that you could find that could actually make a difference, you know?
Sean, before you leave, I just have one more comment. You started off with the restaurant tax. What motivated that concept?
Just as an option, right? So,
Well,
like,
what was the motivation and option? Where did that come from?
comes from just the idea that if a town wanted to find ways to raise new revenue besides just the car tax or the property
So
tax,
you just used restaurants as an example?
just as an example that I've
Okay.
heard.
Well, only because that restaurants is the hardest business to make.
No
It's the
doubt.
number one
No doubt.
least favorite investing positive in the history of investing. When you look at what businesses not to do, restaurants are number one. Okay.
Do you speak from
So,
experience?
no, I don't speak from
Okay.
experience, but I speak from the fact that I've eaten at a lot of restaurants and I've talked to the owners and I understand what they face. You understand they face a lot of material increases, food increases. A lot of these restaurants pick up 5 to 10% on their food. Most of their money is made on,
Totally.
the liquid,
Bar, yeah.
So to go after restaurants, I mean, in my town, restaurants kind of keep my town as the only entertainment we really have. It's the only entertainment cities even have.
Yeah.
You know, nightclubs and environments, late night environments, those are all gone. So yeah. What are you doing? You're living in a city to go to restaurants.
Yeah.
So you start going out to your restaurants. Now you're attacking your only form of entertainment that most of these towns even have.
Yeah. And again, most so people
I would never in a million years get behind a restaurant tax because these people struggle to survive as it is.
And I get it.
Just alone operating the business, let alone competition. And then a restaurant opens up down the street that's popular. And what happens? That restaurant empties out and that one gets all the revenue. So I just wanted to know where that came from because I think it's a horrific idea.
It comes from the idea of you may think it's a horrible idea, and I may agree with you on it, but you may be the mayor of New Haven where there's a zillion restaurants. Mm-hmm. And instead of doing the things he's doing and continuing to ask the state for more and more money, if he thinks that a 1% restaurant tax on the restaurants that all these Yale kids go to.
Well, I'm in Monroe. We don't check enough boxes to get any money.
But what I'm saying is my point is it comes from if the concept of giving other towns the ability to raise revenue is something that's one of the more commonly given examples. Not saying I think it's a good idea, but it's an example.
It sounded like a town could sort of pick and choose what was right for them.
Exactly. So
like the Airbnb tax would be very interesting to us.
Yes. I mean, again, that's a low hanging fruit one, but I go back to the guys at the fair, right?
Well, that might be a great idea, the Airbnb tax, because now you have people coming from out of town into your town, and then that's okay. You're not hitting your own people.
I mean, there is a, that. Currently is an occupancy
it's almost
tax
like an
for
Airbnb
hotels.
You don't get paid.
We don't get.
No, we don't. Yeah, no one gets it. But and not everyone has a hotel. But even the non-coastal towns have Airbnbs in them. I've stayed in some up in the Northwest, wondering.
Yeah, we have some.
Like, I mean, they're not. They don't proliferate like they do in the beach areas, probably in the summer, and aren't getting the amount. But I mean, there is a hotel occupancy tax that's paid by everyone that stays in a hotel.
I'm missing on Main Street in Stratford, and I knocked on the door, and they said, "Well, look here for Airbnb."
Yeah.
Like. This house?
If anybody's into the paranormal, we now have a paranormal Airbnb.
So
that gentleman down at the end certainly would love to meet my wife.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks, Sean.
I'm sorry.
Thanks, Sean.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Cool. Where's my chair?
Great conversation.
I know we got
to
move.
I have to be in Stratford by 12, so I have to leave here no later than 4.
All right, I think this should be, hopefully, we can, well, second presentation is already gone, so we don't have to worry about that.
Oh, Ted left?
Yeah, they're in oral arguments for the Ray case, and he had to go do stuff, so.
Okay, so then.
That's gone.
Let's move to item 5. You want to do that one? To make sure.
Yeah, let's get item 5 done.
All right, so let's go ahead.
Yeah, so action item 5, presentation renewal, as we've talked about a number of times, over the last couple months. Our lease is up in February, March of next year. We started the lease renewal process with our broker, Bruce Wettenstein of Vidal and Wettenstein. During the course of that discussion and negotiation, Southwestern Council on Aging or Agency on Aging next door, they left about 3,500 square feet adjacent to our office. So we were offered, if we wanted to take any piece of that to expand. We thought it was an opportunity to potentially reconfigure the office, allow for an additional conference room, because right now this is the only conference room we have, and we've run into problems where we have scheduling and there's two meetings simultaneously and we don't have another place to go. And also kind of opening up the middle a little bit and adding the capacity potentially for a few more of the workspaces there. Just kind of reconfigure the office, give us a little bit more capacity that we might need in the future, although we don't anticipate them filling it all now. So that was part of the whole discussion. We've come up with a design plan that's been costed out. So the lease renewal that we have, the first year base price, as shown in the memo here, is $2,750 per square foot, which according to Bruce was a very, very good price given the building we're in and the location we are. It does have a 3% per year escalation, which he said was what he's seeing everywhere across Fairfield County from a typical lease. It is a 10-year lease, which gave us a lower rate to start with. The landlord was very receptive to a longer lease term just because it helps them in any sort of refinancing going forward. And I think it helps us from a stability perspective and a financing perspective to know kind of what our 10-year kind of capital outlay is for our lease. Just the overall breakdown of it, the base rent is $12 per square foot. The MetroCog improvement cost that kind of we're covering on a square footage basis is $4.50 per square foot. The operating expenses for the building are 11, and then the costs that are not being covered by us for the improvements, which is kind of the redesign and reconfiguration of this, is about 34, 39 per month. So they're the landlord and the building are taking a significant portion of the cost and kind of eating that from the remodel perspective, to give us kind of a more useful office both now and into the future. Overall, Bruce said he believes that it's a very fair price. It's commensurate with the building and the amenities we have here and the location. And he had no concerns about it. So that's where that is. Happy to answer any questions.
Do you want me to bring a motion to the floor first?
Sure.
Can I have a motion to approve the renewal of the lease?
So moved.
Thanks, Laura.
Second.
Second. Thank you. Okay.
Sorry.
Now, no, that's okay.
Just want to make sure we got there before people.
I really asked you to do that. So, okay. So, any discussion? I think it sounds good to all of us, right? Okay. So, let's take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone against? Okay, that passes unanimously.
Great, thank you all.
Okay, now item six is executive session. So, can I have a motion to go into executive session to talk about legal issues?
So moved.
We need a motion. The motion has to include all the people are participating. The motion on the table. On the floor would be for to move into executive session with First Selectman DeSoro, First Selectman Rooney, Christine Brown as a proxy for First Selectman Vitale, keep saying here, Mayor Hoydick, and First Selectman Bindleglass, myself, Matt Fold, Executive Director, Patrick Carlton, Deputy Director, and Anthony McLeod, Legal Counsel.
Question before you finish that motion. So, First Selectwoman Dragonis, is she part of what we're discussing?
No.
Because she's not part of that. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Emery.
You're muted.
I said, that's okay. I have lots of meetings. I'll talk to you guys later.
You're all the hook, Emery.
Thank you.
You want to make that motion too?
Motion to move into the executive session.
With the aforementioned,
yes, with the aforementioned members of my
yeah, you kind of made the motion,
yeah.
I didn't want to,
but I can't make a motion.
So. Okay,
I just put it out there.
Terry made the motion. Can we have a second?
A second,
thanks. Okay, so it is now 11:15. I'm going to go into the pivot.
Oh, please.
And I know that's an executive session.
Hold on.
Like I'm gonna I want your insight on how we move. Well, I mean, being a resident,
yeah.
I think you being okay.
Okay.
Give me 1 second. We're just setting back up just so we can adjourn.
Pleasure. Yeah.
We're gonna move those items to the next master agenda, right?
Yes.
Yeah, they were just discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, we are back on out of executive session. No votes were taken. We're going to move, they're just going to table the discussion items for the next meeting.
Yeah.
And next meeting dates October 30th, November 20th. And then,
okay. That being said, can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Thank you.
Right. David.
Thanks, David.
All
okay,
good.
We're adjourned.
We're adjourned 11:45.
Thank you, Madam Selectwoman.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you, God.